speaking.
Good morning, Mr. Sasser. This is Janice Kozlowski up in Alaska.
Yes, good morning to you.
Did I call you on the right phone number?
Absolutely.
Okay. Are you willing to allow me to tape our conversation today?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great, great. Thank you so much. Okay, first question for you. What do you remember about the attack on Pearl Harbor? Where were you at the time, and what were you thinking?
I was filming a ride back to school, college, and I heard it over a radio, car radio. And, I don't know, really, the reaction that I had then, they were just stunning, at least. Really, at that particular time, I don't have a great deal of reflection on that day, except I knew where I was.
Do you recall that it made you... Did it propel you into going into the service or any other kind of action like that?
At that particular time, no. I waited until the draft came around, and which was in 1942 in November of 42. That I waited for the draft. We started really in September. With that, we knew we were going. Just as we turned 20 years old, and they drafted us. So I waited for that.
Okay.
I had some ideas of joining the service before that, but then I opted to just to go through the draft.
Okay. And what did they draft you into?
Well, I was. At Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and was sent to from there up to California to Fort Cronkite, just across the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a little cove out there on the Pacific, where the Coast Artillery Battery was located, and that was where I first went. Was to the Coast Artillery.
Did that seem like a good choice for you?
Well, it did to me. I did very well there, and they wanted me to stay, but I didn't get to stay very long in the Coast Artillery. My company commander and some of the sergeants there wanted me to stay with them and did everything they could to keep me, but Captain Willis is... organization of the 7th Provisional Scout Company, he had a carte blanche to call anyone he wanted to and on the West Coast, I guess. So he picked me and about 115 other Mississippi boys to go down to Monterey, California, to Fort Ord. So that's where we went to. From there, we went from the Coast Artillery, I'd say, to the infantry.
Did he pick the Mississippi guys for a reason?
I've often wondered about that. I don't know. I just wondered about it because the company was only... A little over 200 men, and there were more Mississippi guys in it than anybody in it from any other state. But I never did know why that they picked that particular group of guys from up at Fort Cronkite to go down to Fort Ord.
Well, that's interesting. How about you personally? Did you have a skill they were recruiting for?
Pardon me, I missed that question.
Did you have a particular skill that they were recruiting for?
No, I guess not. As far as I know. I just say I have no idea. Maybe they just wanted young guys, you know, that they, perhaps feeling like it, that we were more adventurous than an older person, and most of us were all 20-year-old guys.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they thought those Mississippi boys were reliable and just wanted to keep them together.
I'd like to think that. I'm not sure about that. Perhaps the fact that Mississippi was rural and we worked long and hard, perhaps hardened and accustomed to strenuous work, one reason that they picked us out. But I don't know. I never got an answer to that.
Okay, so where did you go? So you were in training then, and what were they training you for?
Well, we were very curious as to what the 7th Provisional Scout Company, what part that they would play in the war. And the type of training that we were getting, we all suspicioned that it was for some special mission. We did not know what, nor where, but it was very strenuous treatment that we got there in Fort Ord with the 7th Scout Company. The training we got was very severe. But after a period of time, they pulled me off the line, and I started working assistant in the company clerk's office. So that's where I spent the last few weeks with the 7th Scout Company. But again, was transferred to the 50th. Combat engineers, and that was just a few weeks before we went on convoy from Monterey there to San Francisco to board a troop ship. And of course, by that time, we knew where we were going.
Where were you headed?
I avoided by these transfers. Most of the guys that I knew. We're in the 7th Scout Company, so I have a soft spot for those guys there, because I took most of the training, and I knew them all because I was also the mail clerk, and so I knew everybody there by name, and maybe something about them. We had in the 7th Scout Company, we had sergeants that had been involved in the DF raid, had been trained by British commandos, and our training, I assumed, was very much like that the commandos, the training that commandos got.
Well, that sounds like pretty arduous and difficult training then.
It was very severe, yes. Nobody at the camp at Fort Ord, and there were a lot of soldiers there, but when we got out on our speed hikes, there was nobody to keep up with us. We passed everybody. We would hike for an hour and then strip to the waist immediately and take about 30 minutes of calisthenics and then back to putting our clothes on again, our shirts on. I mean, this was with full field pack that we were hiking in, too. So that's a pretty good load itself. But we had a pretty good reputation around the camp there. I mean, the other troops there knew who we were. I don't know where they knew what we were going to do. But those guys went up on a 7th Scout Company group, went up on submarines to. Of course, I avoided that, and I'm thankful for that. But I did come in on Massacre Bay. They landed in on Holt's Bay side of AT-2, which is on the north side, and I landed in the Massacre Bay area, which is on the south side, which was where the majority of the soldiers came in. The 7th Scout Group surfaced, their submarine surfaced about 5,000 yards offshore. And they paddled in to shore from that distance, and then spent a great deal of time in the mountains, snowy mountains. We didn't have that much snow in the valley of Massacre. However, there was snow on top of all the mountains there. Gilbert Ridge is on the east side of Massacre Valley, and the snow was down part of the way, but not all the way. You could travel where the snow had melted and so forth. But in the later at night, you know, at some of those places where the snow had melted, had frozen over. It was difficult to scale the mountains through that area where it was melted. Now, after you got to the snow, you could walk in that with ease, no problem. But it was cold up there, and they had more snow on the mountains on the north side of AT-2 than we had on Massacre.
So did you have good enough equipment for the conditions that you were in?
No, ma'am. We did not have the proper equipment, clothing, that is. I had leather boots when we should have had shoe packs. Of course, remembering this, the prediction of the capture or the retaking of AT-2 was only supposed to take 2 or 3 days, and it lasted for 20 days. So I guess they felt like it didn't matter a great deal as to what sort of equipment that you had. Now we did have rain suits, but that was somewhat of a and it rained a good bit up there, but that could prove a disadvantage to you because of the fact that as you were walking and so forth, you perspire. You didn't get enough air, and you perspired. And then when you sat down to take a break, then you got cold. So it was, the rain suits did keep us dry in one sense, and then on the other hand, you perspired and your clothes got wet from that.
So you were bound to be wet one way or the other.
That's right. At nighttime, after a day of hiking and working where we're trying to get the supplies off of the beach, so forth, we would get in our foxholes and I'd take off our socks, and we would put our socks close to our body and let our body heat dry those socks out overnight. So we had an extra pair of socks for that, but the leather boots were just a bad choice to have given us that. With the shoe packs, we could have done a lot better and been better protected. Now, otherwise, you know, I had enough clothing. I wasn't dressed in, like some have said, that they were dressed in a summer uniform. I was not. I was in wool, and we had a jacket to put over, and so forth. So I didn't experience the real chill factor that some did up in the mountainous area where it was snowed. The 7th Scout Company spent several days. I think they went three days without anything to eat, to drink. They were eating snow for to get some liquid into the system. That's from my talking with them. Most of those boys that were in the Seven Scott Company are deceased now. There is, I know of two that, in Mississippi that are still living. At least they were a year ago. But I haven't bumped into any of the rest of them. I've checked on a few of them, and most of them have deceased. Because I had a copy that I got from the day room, from the company clerk's room, of everybody who was in the Seven Scout Company. So I knew by the serial number which ones were from Mississippi. And, of course, knew the guys pretty well, too. In particular, a mailman is pretty popular, you know, because he's the guy who's going to give you the letter that you're looking for.
Right.
Yeah, that you're hoping is good news, and certainly not a Dear John.
Right, yeah. You were bringing something good to their otherwise rather bleak days, I imagine.
Absolutely. That's true. That's true.
When you said we were sleeping in foxholes at night?
Yes, we had the foxholes there on the just off the beach at Massacre Bay.
So you said you were trying to dry your socks next to your body and
yes.
So forth, but were those foxholes dry?
Well, your body heat would dry them out pretty well.
But were the foxholes themselves dry, or were they wet?
Oh, the foxholes themselves?
Yeah.
Yes, they were dry.
Okay.
They were dry.
And did since you were part of a provisional company, then you probably did okay in terms of food and water and those kinds of things?
Well, now I was not with the provisional scout company. I was transferred to the 50th Combat Engineers before I left Fort Ord. So I did not go up with the guys that I had trained with. They sent me over to the engineers, and I had no engineer training whatsoever.
Oh.
So I was kind of lost. I didn't know what to do. That's the reason, I guess, that I did several detail work, that is, rescuing a few guys that were stranded for one reason or another. And that one night I was with a group of five of us, I believe, that we had one BAR with us. We had, and the rest of us had the old Garand rifles. And we were guarding a pass to Chichikov, I believe it was, or Serrano Bay, I'm not sure which it was. But we were just sitting ducks up there. We would, of course, nothing happened. But that was just to somebody to alert the other troops down in the valley that the Japs were coming. And perhaps by that time it wiped us out if they had come up there. Had that particular detail. And then I had one to rescue a guy up on Gilbert Ridge there that had lost his way, and we got him down from there. Then after we got to Engineer Hill, not known as Engineer Hill at that time, but later after the battle was over, because it was named after the 50th Combat Engineers, actually. That's where everything ended there.
So what happened there that made that the namesake of the 50th?
Pardon?
What happened on that hill that...
Oh, okay. I was doing some detail work out there there as well, as far as my experience. And I had gone out into the valley in front of Engineer Hill with two other guys to pick up a guy that had... He was shell shocked. He He just lost it, and we had to get him back. So we did do that. Coincidentally, it was the same route that the Japanese took when we came and up the valley there to Engineer Hill a few days later after I'd been over there to pick this guy up. And that was a route that they took, same one that we did going out in the valley to get this guy. So all of this on Engineer Hill just happened overnight. Everything seemed to be in good shape. We knew that we had cornered the Japanese, and had no idea that they would make a banzai attack, however. So I and two other guys pitched at the crest of a ravine initially. Then, for some reason or another, we moved up about 40 or 50 yards up the hill, which was close to the embankment from the road that was being built on Engineer Hill and going down into the valley. And so we moved up there, and sometime early in the morning, it must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the sound came that the Japanese had gotten through. Some had gotten through on the other side of us, behind us. And how far they went before they were killed, I don't know. I never did run into them. It was the ones that were in front, coming up the ravines that the engineers encountered. Now, there were other units there on Engineer Hill. There was a medical unit. There was a few other from another engineer outfit entirely. I don't know where they were from or what. There were a few casualties we had there that in a medical tent that were being treated there also. So there was a medical unit there and the engineers, and primarily that was about it.
So
we made our way from where we were when they came up to the ravines, and we made our way up eventually to the roadbed, and where we got into a more secure position. And from there, the Japanese just kept coming up the ravines, and they stacked on top of each other. And some, seeing that everything was futile, nothing they could do, they just took their hand grenades and pulled a pin on it and blew their stomach out completely. Mm. Had a lot of those in the ravines that we discovered after everything had quieted down. After killing them, we had to go down and get them and drag them up there and put them in a grave.
Did you know what was happening? I mean, was the weather good enough that you could you see them? Could you hear what was happening?
We had the vision was not bad. We did have a little flurry of snow that morning. I do recall that. But that wasn't even enough to dust the ground at all. Just a flurry. As far as vision is concerned, we could see a pretty good distance even as daylight came, as it crept in. We could see out into the valley even. And we saw another group of Japanese coming. I don't know how many sorties that they had, But that was one of them. And then those that had gotten behind us, and then there was others that came before that. So it appears to me that, that perhaps there were about three different charges against Engineer Hill, as I can try to piece things together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I survived that with no casualty. The doctor from in the medical unit, he wanted to get into the fight, and he didn't have a rifle. He got a rifle and got up there, and he was next to me. I said next to me, you know, 15 feet or so. And we noticed that he did not make any move, and come to find out he'd been shot right in the head. His name was Bassett was his last name. I think his first name was John, but I'm not positive. He was from San Diego. So since some of the guys had to run up to this embankment so quickly, some did not. Some got up in their bare feet. So we took the boots off of the doctor and let some other guy have it to put his boots on. In my unit, I have no idea how many. I was in headquarters company, so I didn't know guys that were in company, say, A, B, C, or so forth. I didn't know them, so I don't know how many that we lost. I do know that one guy in the headquarters company captured one of the Japanese. So I understood that he made him take off all his clothes. Now, whether that be a fact now, I don't know. I do know the guy was, forgotten his name, but he was from Steubenville, Ohio.
Where did they take Japanese prisoners, do you know?
No idea. I was never aware that we captured any until I heard about the one that this guy in my outfit caught. I didn't know that there was as many as, I think they indicated some 26 maybe. I'm not sure.
Okay.
They did capture some. I don't know on what terms what the conditions were when these guys were captured. I do remember reading about one who was trying to commit suicide, but his hand grenade wouldn't go off, and so he lived and survived it.
Hmm. So you were just 20 years old when you were in the battle there in Attu.
Correct, yes, ma'am. And I had been in the Army only about less than 6 months. I was inducted in November 13th of 1942. We left Fort Ord. We left San Francisco, I believe, on the 22nd or 23rd. Of April. We stopped at Cold Bay, Alaska, because of a storm, and which delayed the initial date of to attack at 2, which was initially scheduled for May the 9th, whereas we took a couple more days. The 11th was when we went in on that too.
And
I didn't go in until the 12th. I stayed aboard ship there for the day, but no action was going on except everybody was working on the beach trying to get all the equipment off of it. Of course, that was a mess there too, because in that tundra, the machinery was bogging down, and they finally learned what to do, and that was get in the little stream where it had a rocky bed, and go and just take this stuff. They had half tracks that they were pulling. They pulled them right up the stream there, and that got them out of the tundra. The tundra is deep. It's I'm sure you perhaps are acquainted with it.
Sure.
Tundra. So, you know, it's up to about the knee level, I guess. Pretty hard to travel in it.
So did your training prepare you for that kind of travel?
Not at all. My Seven Scout Company did, yes. Yes, my Seven Scout Company did. But my combat engineer, I had no training whatsoever in the 50th Combat. None whatsoever. It was just to do what I could, I guess, for self-preservation, as well as doing my duty to follow orders to, say, rescue someone or to go out on this with this group or that group and so forth. And that was about it for me.
You had your youth and fitness going for you.
Pardon?
You had your youth and fitness going for you.
I did. I sure did. Yes, ma'am. I was an athlete in high school. I didn't play college ball. They looked at me as a freshman for basketball, but I could have gone out, but I didn't. I didn't choose to do that.
Well, when did you find out that you were going to Alaska?
I was doing some work with some officers from in the 50th Combat, and we were doing some stencil. I was doing some typing and some stencil work, and one of the officers got a map out for us, and he said he circled it. He circled Alaska and all the whole chain, Lucian chain. It said, we're going up there somewhere. He didn't know what the time were. But that's when we knew we were going.
And what did you think about that? Did it make a difference to you where you went? Or?
Pardon?
Did it make a difference to you where you went? Or did you
Really, it really did, because I always wanted to go to Europe. Myself, rather than to be out on a desolate island in the Pacific, but you know, I wouldn't take anything for the experience of what I had there. I think I grew up not only physically but mentally as well. It made me know that. That I was a survivor, that I knew how to survive for a long period of time. I could do that, and I just knew how to take care of myself and those around me.
So it matured you.
It surely did, yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
After the battle, I spent 21 months up there. Then after this. At two, I went over to ADAC, a staging area, before going into Kiska, and I went on Kiska as well.
So what did they have you do at ADAC?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, what did they have you do at ADAC?
We really did nothing. It was just a staging area. It rained, I think, every day we were there. We were sleeping in pup tents. We had to do a trench around our pup tents to try to drain the water off, but it still got inside the pup tent, and we still got wet. But, it was in July. It wasn't all that bad, and wasn't that cold. So we did all right on that, but we did no training whatsoever.
Hmm.
It was just a staging area before going. We left ADAC and went to Kiska. I don't know what ship I was on at that time. A troop ship, of course, but I landed at Gertrude Cove on Kiska. And I can't tell you a great deal about that. It was just I stayed on there for maybe 30 days and went back to that too. And that's where, totally, the thought that I would try to see if I could enlarge my vocabulary. And so I began to, as I read the Time magazine or whatever I was reading and came across words, I'd copy them down, looking in the dictionary, and finally got to where I'd use those words in my vocabulary. And by the way, I copied those down in a little notebook, and I still have it, by the way. I brought it home with me. I wish that I had a diary of my activities and really what happened day by day up there, but that's hindsight now. When I got on a train at Camp Shelby to go out to went to Sausalito. That's where we got off for there, train there. I did have a daily diary, so I still had that. I was writing letters for guys. We had a lot of illiteracy here in Mississippi, and many of the boys that went out to California could not write their names. They couldn't even write their wives. So I was kind of a self-appointed writer for those guys, and some of them I was trying to teach them how to write the names. But later they bust those guys into the University of San Francisco, and they taught them there really how to write the names. I didn't know the technique for it, how to go about that. I'm not a teacher, so I didn't know how to instruct them really.
So when were you instructing the guys in the 50th when you were in Alaska? Is that what you're talking about?
No, ma'am. I was talking about the ones that were in Fort Cronkite.
Oh, okay.
When we were up at Fort Cronkite.
Okay. When you were the mail clerk there.
I was not the mail clerk there. I did do some. I'd had some ROTC training. So I was out teaching them how to about face and right oblique, left oblique, to the rear march and such. I was doing that.
Okay.
And I think that being able to do that so forth, the officers and the sergeants saw that I probably had a little more training than the others. That's one reason, I guess, that they wanted to keep me.
Sounds like you served a useful role there.
Well, I guess I did. I suppose so. I used to do the writing on that too for the cook was a Chinese guy. His name was Hong Yi Tommy Hum, and he and I got to be real good friends. And but he couldn't write, he didn't know how to write. So I wrote his love letters for him. Back. He came from Pueblo, Colorado. So I wrote his letters for him.
Well,
I believe he's the only one that I did, yeah. By that time, I would say I'd been separated from the guys, most of the guys that I went into service with, Mississippi. I was not with them anymore. One or two that stayed with me and was transferred every time that I was.
Did you cross paths with them anywhere?
Did we do what?
Did you cross paths with them anywhere?
No, yes. The 7th Scout Company after the battle.
Mm-hmm.
My path crossed a few of those guys. After AT 2, those men who were able from the 7th Provisional Scout Company, and which were very few, they went on they went down to Hawaii and then went to a Kwajalein out in the Pacific out there, South Pacific. In fact, I talked to a guy just before we left there, and he was killed there on that too. He was from a little town up north of where I live here in Carthage, and he was killed there. He had gotten a Japanese flag. He showed it to me. Then one guy was from my county. I bumped into him as I was going over to ADAC from AT-2. As before going into Kiska. He was on a board ship, but he was on his way back. They sent him back to the States. I don't think out of that 200 and some odd men with the 7th Scout Company, there wasn't but about 20 or so that was able to walk out of there. They had frostbite and gangrene set in, and they just all kinds of things happened to them.
That's a pretty high casualty rate.
It was, absolutely. We had a professional boxer in our outfit. His name was Stanley Hashrato from Pennsylvania. He was an up-and-coming boxer and had boxed some pretty high-class boxers, I'd say. He got his feet frozen, had to amputate some of his toes. Of course, that ruined his boxing career. Might have been a good thing for him. I didn't like the cruelty of boxing anyhow, but he couldn't box anymore after that because he lost those toes and you don't have the balance that's necessary.
Right.
To put those toes away, you know, take it off.
So that was on ATU, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So did you the combat engineers, did they did quite a few kind of recoveries of people that had Americans who had died or who had injuries where they couldn't get out? You were kind of a rescue crew?
Well, that's what they used us, a few of us, in the headquarters company. Now, if you were in another company there, they were trained in using caterpillars and half tracks and such as that, moving the equipment and supplies off of the beach. But I was not trained in that. I knew nothing about it. I didn't know anything about the surveying department. There was no training in that. So I was just kind of a loose gun, I guess you call it. And so when they needed a detail, I was it.
Mm-hmm. So you did a variety of things then, it sounds like.
But rescue
was part of it. When you rescued guys, where did you take them?
We brought them back to the medical unit.
And was that on board the ship?
Medical station. No. This was on land. This was on air too.
Oh, okay.
We brought them back to the medical tent and left them there. Nobody know what happened to them after that.
Did you also recover men who had died in the battle?
Not of our men, no.
Okay.
I was involved in that. I was involved only in getting these Japanese out of these ravines that were coming up from the valley up Engineer Hill.
And what did you do
we
with...
Would, oh. Pardon me. We would put a rope around their foot, their feet, and drag them up the hill. And where a bulldozer had just dug a hole, we would dump them in that hole. I don't know how many would be in one grave even. There'd be 10 or 15.
Later on,
if I understand it, that the Japanese came out to it and got all those guys, took them back.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so the graves were somewhere near the road, somewhere...
Yes, ma'am, it sure was. Yes, it was.
Okay.
And it was their own Engineer Hill where they were all buried. Well, I say all of them in that particular part of the battle, meaning that the Banzai attack, that was a group that we were dealing with.
How did all that, the battle and, you know, seeing dead people, how did that affect you at that young age?
Well, that's a good question. Frankly, when I got to Engineer Hill, there had already been a battle just around the corner from that at the foot of Knees Peak. And Knees Peak is at the end of Gilbert Ridge. And there were foxholes all out there. So when we came up and made the turn to go to Engineer Hill, there were five, six, seven, maybe dead Japanese laying around there. Well, frankly, I was a bit nauseated at it, but I tell you, I saw so much of it before the day was over. I got used to it. It didn't bother me.
Did you see?
It doesn't bother me today either, you know.
So as you look back, you don't have bad memories of or memories that haunt you about that battle?
No, I don't. And I've often wondered. In my dreams, I have never dreamed about that part of my service in the Army. We had to. My dreams have never been there about that. I often wondered why, because that was something different when you called upon to man a rifle and you shoot kill. It's a difficult thing.
Well, maybe that's a blessing. But you weren't haunted by that your whole life.
Yes, ma'am, that's true.
Did you see other fellows in the 50th or others that you encountered during the battle of either Kiska or Attu that really had a hard time handling the experience?
I never saw anybody that had any problem whatsoever. We did have one guy that, and I don't know what his trouble was. It might not have been the experience on that too, but we did have one guy that did have some nervous problems, and I don't know what happened to him. He might have been wanting to get out of the service, so we just never did figure him out. But that's the only one that I can recall. But he did have some mental problems, some anxieties. There that rather strange, like I can't explain what they were, but you know, you just tell that he was different, and that he responded differently than others would.
So the 2 weeks or so that you were on Attu, sleeping outside and maybe cold and wet during that period, were you pretty exhausted when it was over?
No, ma'am, I tell you the truth, I wanted a bath so bad I didn't know what to do. I hadn't had one since about April 24th or 5th, something like that. I think I took one bath on the troop ship, and they were stacked up six deep on the ship, and I just didn't like the idea of sleeping that close. And so there was a Hispanic guy named Delgado, and I got together, and we went down a floor below where all the barracks bags were, and they were pretty soft. And rather than sleep up there with the rest of them, we slept down in the hold down there. Another thing there that, you know, that if I can improvise the things, and if they things are not going normally, I can move to something, an alternative, and substitute something in the place of it, get along with it. There again, I think that's a part of my just being a survivor.
Right. Mm-hmm. That adaptability, I'm sure, was very important in the war.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Sure was. One of the best experiences I had in the service was the time that I spent at Washington Lee University. I really enjoyed that. I was over there for I think about a month. I'm not sure how long, but we were taking training so that the troops that were coming back to the States there, they could have some recreation for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just learning how to do that. We had Ivy League coaches there, and back in the 40s, that's when Ivy League football was in the heyday. So, and the names of those guys I didn't copy down. There again, too, I wish that I had written down the names of those coaches, because they were well known in the athletic field. We had an All-American football player from University of Texas, I recall, his being there at Washington and Lee. But most of it was along the athletic range of entertainment, and the other part would be of working up skits and putting on a little play of some sort. We had the advantage, at least when I was there. I think they had a new class coming in every month. We had the advantage of these guys that had been in the stage performance of This is the Army, Mr. Jones. It was on Broadway, I guess, in New York, and they did their last performance, and those guys had to go somewhere. Well, a lot of them wound up at this special service school at Washington and Lee when I was there. So we had to put on a skit, and those guys were really helpful in helping us put that thing together. I was a squad leader because I was the tallest in the group. For no other reason I got that honor or position. And my group came in second on the skit. We had to do one for the Built by the Sea, but we didn't win, but we did come in second.
Well, that's pretty darn good.
I thought it was too.
Now, were you at Washington?
We couldn't have done that without those guys. So coming from that that Broadway play up there. I think I have a record somewhere. I do. That when they were all of them sang the last tune and so forth, and they just disbanded it. I think I have a record of that here in my library.
Oh. Is that when you became interested in music?
No, ma'am. I became interested in music when I was, I was about 12 or 13 years old. And I had a sister that was 3 years older than I was. And my mother wouldn't let her go out and dance back then. We're talking about back in the 30s and early 30s. So she wanted somebody to dance with. So she got me. And taught me how to dance At that particular time, I despised it. But after that, I always loved her for having taught me how to dance. So that was quite a thing on the music end of it. I always liked music. I had collected a few records before I went into service. I went off to school that summer, college that summer before I went into service, and had it with a suitcase full of records, took them to school and left them. I wish I'd have kept them later, but I left all those records. And I don't know, I've just always liked music. It was just we had the radios to listen to. I used to catch the live broadcasts from stations located out of New Orleans. We used to pick up a station up in Pennsylvania, and Atlanta, and Nashville, Tennessee, and around. I just like the music. The big band really was what I liked best of all. I have a lot of copies of that, the big bands as they played live that I've transposed over to a CD. I bought cassettes, but I enjoyed that when I was a kid on radio, car radios, and we can. There was an advantage, really, to radio back then, because you and your own imagination could picture what was going on there. Now you can see what's going on there with television. But I always thought that, you know, what I think is going on there as I listen to that music, my friend over here is listening to the same thing. He probably looks at it a little differently than I.
Mm-hmm.
So I still like radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I collect radios. I have about 10 or 15, I guess, old radios. Well, I have gone into it in a big way, but and I've got still old ones too.
Were you able to continue your interest, pursuing your interest in music while you were in the service? Were there opportunities there?
No opportunities, no ma'am.
So it wasn't until after you got back out of the service that you could continue to pursue that interest?
And I didn't for a good while. But there was a period of the 50s and 60s that I just divorced myself from it, but my wife didn't dance, so that one thing is that I just kind of left it alone, and then our children came along and that, but I still kind of kept in touch with music.
Mm-hmm.
And until I really got involved in it about 25 to 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep, life got busy there for a while.
Absolutely. I have been transferring some music from tapes that I made 25 years ago. And I had 17 tapes, 2 hours each. And we just finished recording those from the tape. There are 34 CDs now that I have on the big band, and singers too, you know, Donna Shore and Margaret Whiting and Joe Stafford. Singers that I like very much. Patti Page came on a little bit at the end of the war. Doris Day was and many others. I have about four albums of music, CDs. Each album contains about 40 CDs.
Mm. I love that era, too. It sounds like you have quite a collection.
Yes, ma'am, I do. Mm. I do. And then I have other CDs that I have made besides that, which, I don't know how. I never did count them, so I don't know how many I have then. But it's been fun. My wife was ill from the time she was about 35 years old, a little less even than that. And that occupied a good bit of my time. I had to have a hobby, and music was one of them. I got into the trapping of fox and raccoons. I even had a trapper to get me some enough raccoon skins to. I sent it up to Monarch in New Jersey. I believe they tanned them for me, and then I sent them to this guy in Wisconsin. It made me a raccoon coat.
Oh, do you still have it?
I still have it, yes, ma'am. And I still wear it.
Oh, I bet that's nice.
I haven't grown out of it. I'm still kind of skinny. But then I decided, well, since we're trapping it, why don't I just do that for get something for my daughter? So I got the a red fox for my middle daughter, and she got a coat made for her. She liked that real well. My oldest daughter decided that she would have a gray fox. So I bought enough of those and cut out the white belly, but they have a little tinge of red in it, red and gray. Real pretty coat.
Sounds beautiful.
Then I got out to my youngest daughter. That's the last one. I said, "Well, Joanne, what kind of fur coat do you want?" She said, "I believe I'll just go to the store and buy me a blue fox." So I got coat there in that one.
So
she still got that fur blue fox. It was pretty.
Yeah, oh,
we had blue fox on that too.
Did you?
I got a picture of me with holding a little baby blue fox there.
Oh, so you saw them there?
Pardon?
You saw them on Attu?
Yeah, that's it. And you know they named that theater there on Attu, the Fox Theater.
Oh, after the blue fox?
Oh yeah, after the blue fox.
Oh.
That's what I assume. I've got a picture of that theater there.
And that's where, is that where they played movies?
Yes, ma'am. In fact, Earl Flynn came over, and he and some girl, don't recall who she was, but they put on a performance for us.
Did you get many USO shows like that while you were in the Aleutians?
We had a group. One girl was a violinist. She was a violinist with the Phil Spitale Orchestra. There was an all-girl orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And she played the violin. I recall her because it happened to be real, real cold. And I had, I was aboard ship, troop ship, I got one of those Navy masks to wear. My face, and I rounded the corner one day and ran into that girl violinist, and she liked to faint it. That when she saw me with that black mask on, and first she didn't know what to get into. I guess some different kind of animal, I reckon.
Hey, can I travel you back to Kiska for a minute?
me. I didn't hear that question.
Well, let me ask you first. You've been talking for about an hour. Do you still have a little time, or would you like to wrap
up? I got all the time you want, ma'am.
Okay. Can I ask you some questions about Kiska?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
So what do you remember happening on Kiska when you landed at Gertrude Cove?
Gertrude Cove. I recall this, that it was the coastline was pretty rough with rocks and such as that. It was a little bit difficult getting from the ship on shore. And getting there, I don't remember a lot about it because, really, after we got over there, there was nobody. It was just us and no Jeffs. There wasn't anything to do.
How long did it take you to realize there wasn't anybody there?
I think it was on the second day. I don't recall the exact date that we went on Kiska, but I did go in on the first day of invasion there. And we followed on. I think it was the second day.
Okay. Do you remember what the weather was like at the time? Could you see what was happening and know that?
There was a lot of fog. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of fog there.
So that
fog. That's the reason that we had the casualties that we had was because of the fog. You saw an object there, and you knew that you were positioned here, and he was positioned out in front, and you assumed that he was enemy, and we did have some. I don't know what the number of deaths were, but not a lot, but even one, you know, is a death.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Did the 50th
even had one of them?
Did the 50th suffer any casualties there?
Did what?
Did the 50th suffer any casualties there?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. I don't recall any of them having any. I don't recall any.
Did you feel relieved after a couple days to realize that it was over?
Yes, ma'am. We certainly were. We certainly were. They moved out quite a number of men from Kiska. Of course, in fog, you know, they were able to evade our Navy and get out of there. It was a great move for the Japanese. I don't call things lucky, but providentially, things just worked out for them. That they were able to get in there during the fog and the fog going out. And get beyond the reach of our Navy.
Mm-hmm.
They did leave a lot of boot traps on the east. And there were some casualties from that. Now, to what extent, I don't know. There was none in my outfit. This was what people told me.
Did you remember seeing evidence of the Japanese occupation when you landed at Gertrude Cove?
Not at Gertrude Cove, no, ma'am. I saw it as we advanced on inward there at the airport that they were building there, and I think they had they left a plane or two, I believe, there at the old airport.
So
they had very crudely been working on that. They didn't have the real equipment like we had. And create a, say, like a landing strip as quickly as ours. They just didn't have the equipment there.
So if you got all the way over to the airstrip, you marched pretty far from Gertrude Cove across the island.
Yeah, well, I was over there.
Yeah, that must have been a tough travel overland on that island.
You know, I don't recall how I got over there, but I do remember that landing strip that they had.
Well, I've been to Kiska.
There's also a volcano on Kiska.
Did you see that when you were there?
But didn't erupt while we were there. But I understood that there was one, and also there's one on deck.
Oh, uh-huh. Yep.
Volcano, both of those mm-hmm. islands there.
Did you work with Canadian troops when you were on Kiska?
No, I didn't. I did not. I was aware of Canadian troops being there. In fact, I encountered them on at 2 before, and I assumed that they were transported over to ADAC as a staging area before going into Kiska, but I didn't know. I didn't encounter any of the Canadian troops on Kiska.
Okay.
But I did see them, on at 2 before we went over to ADAC.
Okay. And do you remember if you had good air support on Attu or Kiska?
I don't know. I'm not aware of any air attack on Kiska. Well, I know that there was from reading it, but nothing when we landed that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I don't know whether they had any battleship or anything like that that was bombing the island
mm-hmm.
As well. Now, on that too, that day that I didn't go in on the 11th, I was standing out on the deck of my troop ship there, and that battleship Pennsylvania was letting them go pretty fast. They would shake my britchy leg, I recall that. But they were quite some distance from her. But, you know, the Navy at Kiska, other than the troop ship I was on, I don't recall any air attacked bombing before we went in, but I'm sure that there was.
Mm-hmm.
I understood they had really plastered Kiska, but the day I went in, I don't recall anything of that nature.
Okay. Do you recall the name of the troop ship that you were based on?
No, ma'am, I can't. There was. I got on one troop ship, and it seems to me like that the name of that was, I've got it somewhere here in my stuff, because I think it was called the Xylem. And how do you spell it? I can't tell you. I wound up on that, and I think it was a hospital ship.
Did you say Xylem, like with a Z?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I've got the name of that because it came out in a paper here in Mississippi about these guys down here in old south of where I live that were on that ship, and I recognized the name, so I cut the article out, wrote a letter to the guy, and got a response from him.
Hmm.
So I've got the name of it of one of the troop ship, so it was up there. Now, it might have been the hospital ship. It may not have been. But I think the name of it was Xylem.
Okay.
I can find it sometime.
Okay.
If you'd like to have that name, I think I can get it for you.
Okay, that'd be great. I'll do some research myself, too, and see if I can find it, just in case.
All right. Okay.
Okay, tell me what... So then they pulled you off of Kiska, then what happened? Are you still there?
Bottom boat or ship or whatever they call it. And every time that the waves would hit that bottom, you know, you'd think that they were going to crack half in two, but it didn't.
Mr. Sasser,
Yes, ma'am.
Somehow you cut out a little bit, so when I asked you what happened...
Is that right? I'm hearing you very plainly.
Your phone cut out. I asked you what happened when they pulled you off Kiska, could you start over, please?
I could, yes, ma'am. We went from Kiska to Attu, and we got on a flat-bottom ship or a boat. I don't know what they'd call it. And I do recall that as the waves would hit that bottom of that boat there, it would just the whole thing would shake. You know, I'm trying to think of the distance between Kiska and Attu. I got it in my mind of maybe 200 miles, but I'm not sure about that.
It's a long way.
I'm not sure how many were on that ship that we were on. It was in July, August, or something like that, I guess, when we went back to Attu. Then I went back to my old outfit.
It sounds like that was a long, memorable ride between
It was, I tell you. I just thought that boat was going to break half in two, but that might have been one of those Higgins boats.
Okay.
And who built a lot of them. And by the way, while we're talking about that, my very good friend is the only survivor and a daughter of Andrew Jackson Higgins, who made those boats.
Tell me that again. Your oldest daughter?
A good friend of mine is Dawn Higgins Murphy, and she is the only daughter of survivor of the family of Andrew Jackson Higgins, who made the Higgins boats in New Orleans and around the country in World War II.
Oh, yes, he's a famous guy.
She lives in Jackson, Mississippi, and I gave a program in Jackson to some veterans a few years ago, and it was about music. The part that music played in World War II. I think the title is Music, the Not Too Silent Weapon of World War II. And she is an accomplished pianist. Are you here still with me?
Yes, I'm here with you.
Okay, all right, good. So I could see as I played a little music and so forth, and I saw her patting her foot, then I went out and start talking to her, introduce myself to her, and so forth. And since then, we've become real good friends. She likes music, particularly piano music, and I do too. And so I had come across a lot of different types of music and piano playing, even the old ragtime piano, honky-tonk piano. I'm not semi-classical or classical-minded, so I don't have that. But we got to be real good friends, and I keep in touch with Dawn and Bob. In fact, my Aleutian Island group met here in Jackson a few years ago, two or three years ago, and I got them to come out and I wanted Dawn to present the program, but her husband just did an excellent job of doing it and telling us all about Higgins and how it began. And they also have a book out of Andrew Jackson Higgins that is an excellent book. I enjoyed it very much.
Do you remember the name of it?
I think that's the name of it.
Okay.
Andrew Jackson Higgins. I don't want studio office not right now. I'm not at the house. I've got that book, it's a good book about his life.
I'll have to see if I can find that.
He was quite a guy. He drank hard and he worked hard, and he was somewhat of a genius in a sense. He knew how to get things done, and to get them done on time. things like that, too. For instance, if a person tells me they're going to be here at, we had an appointment at 10:30, and you called at 10:30. Now, if it's been 10:45 or 10:50, and I hadn't heard from you, I almost feel like I've been stood up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if I can't make an appointment be there at the designated time, I'll call an individual and tell them I can't make it. But you know, so many people don't do that. So you sit there and you wait and you wait. They never show up. I told somebody one, kind of riled up one time. Lady that said she would come over at a certain time, a certain day. And I just finally told her, I said, you know, I set that whole day for that appointment with you, and you never showed up, you never called. I said, don't ever do that again to me. I tried to do it not too harshly to a lady, but I tried to get my message over. I like promise.
Yeah, that's just not good behavior.
That's not. It's really not, and it's really an imposition on the person that they have to wait. So I appreciated your being right on time.
Well, I always try and be.
I sent you some pictures.
I got those just yesterday, and I wanted to thank you for them. These are beautiful.
Well, I just thought that you might know what your subject looked like.
Well, I've had them sitting out here as we're talking, so I feel like I'm talking to you.
All right. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I don't know what we can talk about. Any other questions you'd like to ask?
Can I just ask you couple other things about you finishing out the war? Did you what happened after you they took you out of Alaska? You continued to serve in the war capacity, right?
Yes, ma'am. When I came back, I came to Camp Funston, Kansas. That's adjacent to Fort Riley. And from there, that's when I went to Washington and Lee University for a month and then came back. Then we were transferred, all of us went on maneuvers down to, we went down to Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. That's on the eastern side of the state of Oklahoma. And, well, I was the mail clerk there and did a few other things. We went to Chicago on a truck driver strike and sat with truck drivers, scabs, as they moved the perishables over to Chicago. And we slept in Marquette Park on the south side. And one of our guys stole a trolley car. We were there, and they didn't do anything with him. Guys are always looking for some kind of entertainment, and so he did that. Then that was in July of 1945. Then we went on maneuvers, and we went to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. That's out from Fort Polk, Louisiana, close to Columbia. I'm not sure what city it was close by. Anyhow, I never did go to the city. I went to Baton Rouge when I could take off from there. But there's about 102 or 3 out in the woods and mosquitoes.
Oh.
Nets and so forth, keep mosquitoes off of us. We were preparing to go back, and we were going into, we understood that our area would be in the, in India area, where we would be. Now, that would be from where we would go there first, I guess, as a staging area, And later, the World War II Museum in New Orleans sent me a map of just exactly what the strategy was in attacking Japan.
Mm.
And so I looked from that map, and we're talking about the different units. And from that, I figured out that I would be going in and from the India area. That was very, very, very interesting to me to get that map and to see that. And of course, thankfully that President Truman authorized the atomic bomb. We saved a lot of lives by that atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would have been a bloody bath, I mean, for the Americans to have gone in Japan and fought on their ground. It would have been a house-to-house situation. And with their belief and such as that it's an honor to die for their emperor and such as that, that made them a lot more tenacious and difficult to rout out. So I was glad. I was in Baton Rouge when we heard that. No, what? I was on camp up there. I think I left. It came out that day at the Camp Claiborne, and somehow or another we escaped down to Baton Rouge to celebrate.
So you were grateful to hear that.
That kind of finished me up. I was discharged, went back from Camp Claiborne to Muskogee, Oklahoma, to Camp Gruba, and was discharged there.
Okay.
And I think October, November, forgot which, so 1945. I got out pretty early because of the number of months that I had spent in the Aleutian Islands, the 21 months. Gave me a lot of points, so I got out pretty early.
And
some of the guys that I had been associated with there, they didn't get out till 46.
Mm. So it all depended on points.
The points you had, that's right.
Yeah.
They gave you stripes for every 6 months that you were overseas. Mm-hmm. In a sense, I guess I wasn't overseas because I was still on American territory. But I guess they considered it being that.
Uh-huh.
After all, you know, that territory there that we were taking back was, you know, was maybe the only land that we got back from the Japanese. I'm not sure of that. There's something connected with Attu and it being recaptured and Japanese had taken part of America.
Mm-hmm.
They got it.
Yeah.
Well, I always said about the Aleutian Islands since I've been up there that Seward did one good thing in purchasing the Alaska and Aleutian Islands for $7,200,000, I forget, somewhere like that. That some of the other things he did while he was in office was very detrimental to the South. I'll put it that way generally. He wasn't very kind to us. I'll say that.
Mm.
I'm old enough that I remember my grandmother telling me about the Yankees coming across Mississippi from Meridian, going across through Meridian to Jackson and to Vicksburg, and that they had the barrier there. She was 12 or 13 years old at that time. She lived to be 89 years old.
Oh.
So I got to talk to her before she passed away.
I bet she had some interesting stories.
Pardon?
She must have had some interesting stories.
Well, it was, yes. And the fact that she remembered those as a little girl, you know, 12 or 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So before they had to bear the food and bear the valuables in the ground, and the Yankees made a trip across the state of Mississippi, and they it followed a major highway that goes across the state of Mississippi. It was Highway 80, U.S. 80, and so on either side of that is what the Yankees that was their route across Mississippi, and so it went through the place where my grandmother lived there.
Mm.
So that's kind of the story of my life, I guess. You heard most of it.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today. I hope I didn't keep you too long.
Not at all. I set aside today. I got up real early this morning. If I got up at 5 o'clock our time here, and I did business transaction. A friend of mine from Jackson has spent the night with me last night, and he and I had some business to attend to. My wife is deceased, so I've got the old house by myself. So he came over and spent the night when we attended our business. So he had to get back. He was having a wedding at his house this week for a couple from North Carolina. Then he was going to Mayo Clinic, and then he was going to the Catskills in New York, and I think he'd be back. Oh, he's going up to Upper Michigan, too.
Oh, boy.
He just got back from Paris. Not Paris. He flew to Paris and then drove on down to Nice, pretty close to Nice.
Mm.
But he's one of my rich friends.
Sounds like he really gets around.
He has his own private plane too, by the way. He's a retired Navy Reserve. He was a pilot. He got out as a admiral. So he did pretty good. He's a good pilot, I know that.
He pilots his own aircraft?
Yes, he does.
Oh.
Still does. Yeah, he's 70-some-odd years old, but he's still doing that. Still gets his physicals. The Navy provides him for a physical, I believe, every year.
Oh, that's great.
And then he gets another one, or gets another opinion on his own at Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So he travels about a good bit. They on the road fine. I wish you could see their house. Oh, boy.
Beautiful, huh?
I can't tell you. He got about 15 or 20 acres and a lake and a house that I think the ceiling's so high. I looked for a cloud up there. See if there's a cloud up there. So, excuse my rain. Ceilings are so high. I spent the night with him not too long ago, but we enjoy each other. We've been a member of a poker party for about, since 1958, and I since 1953. Mm-hmm. Only two of us that remain living from the original poker group that started in 1953.
Boy, that's a long.
It's a friendly one. We have limits, and you can't lose over $5 or $10 at all. You could if you lost every hand. And two, my preacher lives next door to this little place where we play, and he comes over and has a beer with us and talks with us, and then he leaves and so forth. But
Sounds
wants to come over, that's fine. We don't care.
Sounds like a nice group.
Yeah, it is. It is. Good group. It's good. It's something that you kind of look forward to. Kind of offbeat from your normal paths that you, everyday things that you do. And we get to meet each other, kind of kid each other about. And we had fist fights and we don't get ugly with each other. It's strictly strictly recreational. That's it.
It's good to have friends like that.
Good to have them, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Sasser, I'll let you go. I bet you've got a big day planned. You seem like a pretty active fella, so...
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do this afternoon. I'm trying to clean up this studio and office so that my nephews will not think too unkindly of me when they come up. One's from South Carolina and one from Florida coming in next Wednesday. And spend the rest of the week with me. And my daughter from Houston, Texas is coming, and she'll be staying with me. And I have two daughters in Jackson, only 53 miles from here. So we all plan to get together.
Kind of a family.
Enjoy ourselves.
A little family reunion.
Little family reunion, that's right.
That sounds nice.
One of my nephew just sold his company. He asked me if I'd seen it in the Wall Street Journal. I said, no, I won't even take it, Wall Street Journal anymore. So I may go by the bank up there and let me see if I can read theirs. But I never did get by there. But he sold his business for $200 million. So
he came out
pretty good, I thought.
Yeah, he sounds very successful.
I believe he can live comfortably. Yeah. And he's getting ready to retire, by the way. I told him, I said, well, thank goodness. I said, I think you fixed up well enough that you'll be able to enjoy your retirement.
Absolutely.
And my other oldest nephew, he's already been retired for quite some time. He owned a part of the Orlando Magics, I think they call them, NFL basketball, National basketball, the NBA, National Basketball Association. Yeah. I think he got the Magics. He was in on the initial buy there. He sold out though a number of years ago. But,
that was a good buy.
It was a good purchase, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Sure was.
Well,
I lost my sister about 2 years ago. She passed away, and I'm the only one left. So I depend on my friends, and they've been very kind to me. And my daughters are very loving girls, and they love their daddy. And when they call on me, I'm always here, and they need me. One of them's moving, so she asked me to come down. So I went day before yesterday. I drove down to Jackson to see where she was moving and what kind of house. So. She was selling her house, and she just about a swap, but she's getting into really a little bit better neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson, Mississippi has got some bad areas. Have a lot of killings, a lot of murders. But you know, it's mostly, it's mostly black on black.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is. It's a life, you know. I don't care what color it is, you know. It's a life and a soul, and it's just sad that it's that way. But a lot of these cities are that way. New Orleans, you need to watch out where you go down in.
Yeah.
Y'all may not have that problem up there.
Oh, we do. We do have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not as bad as some of the bigger cities, but we do have those problems too. Yeah.
Well, listen. If I can be of any further help to you, if you got any further questions or something, just give me a call. I'd be glad to talk with you again.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Well, my pleasure too. I enjoyed it very much, and maybe we'll just keep in touch with each other.
Yes, let's do that.
Alrighty, that sounds good to me.
Well, you
have a good day here.
You too. You take care.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye.